So we'll continue our discussion now into some theory talks. Yifar is going to tell us about other quantum politics. Yifar.
Thank you. So yeah, first of all, let me thank the organizers for inviting me to this exciting workshop, which was extremely educational for me. So basically the talk is composed of two pretty much disconnected parts, and so the reason that I want to tell you about these two problems is that although they're not exactly on the spin-hole effect, but I guess the whole session is on the things which are related but not necessarily the same, but somehow they are definitely related to quantum Hall effects, and one is the what can be termed a quantum valley Hall effect, and the other is basically spontaneous integer quantum Hall effect. So not to forget, let me also acknowledge my collaborators. So on the first project, these were Yaroslav Blanter and Alberto Marpurga, who is in fact, as many of you know, is experimentalist, so he adds a little bit to the credibility of some of the proposals that we make for experiments. And so in the second problem, my collaborator was Christian Batista. Okay, so yeah, so let me just, from the get-go, explain a little bit what these two effects are, because we run out of time, then at least you won't miss too much. So the valley Hall effect, obviously the playground for this effect will be graphene. Moreover, it will be non-interacting system. And the connection with the spin Hall effect is that valley, as you know, is pretty much the same kind of degree of freedom as a spin. So the difference really is that a valley, as you know, is something which is defined at low energies close to the middle of the band in graphene, and as you go sort of to the edges of the Brillouin zone or to high energies, it really loses its meaning. It's not like spin, which is something which emerges obviously at energies of about 500 kiloelectron volts. So that's, I guess, the major difference. Otherwise, the phenomenology, as you'll see, is very similar. You also get H states and such. And in fact, sort of that's the simplest pictorial representation of the effects, is that if you drive a current through graphene, which has to be gaps, which has to be massive, then electrons from one valley get deflected one way, and electrons from the other valley get deflected the other way, regardless of their spin.
Okay. But even there are fundamental differences, by the way, the time reversal symmetry acts.
So this system is obviously time reversal invariant as well.
No, but there's a difference between t squared equals to 1 and t squared equals to minus 1.
Okay.
Quantum spin Hall effect comes only about because of t squared equals to minus 1.
That's right. No, I'm not claiming that the effects are identical, but there is an interesting relationship.
Protection, right?
So there is no protection against backscattering, let's say, by potential impurities, anything which mixes the valleys.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, let's say, whether you have, let's say, spin scattering or spin orbit scattering, as far as it is smooth, it doesn't matter. So basically, there is a give and take. So in some respects, it's more stable, and in other respects, it's less stable. Okay. So we'll get to that.
More stable? Right? Why is it more stable?
Well, for example, if you put scattering which doesn't conserve time reversal, in fact, you can still have this valley Hall effect. So in this sense.
So you put magnetic impurities on top?
That's right. So, I mean, the constraint has to be that this magnetic impurity has to be smooth. It cannot be point-like, because if it is point-like, then it will basically just change the valley. So that will be the first part. And the second part, I mean, as far as fraction of time, I'm probably going to devote at best like two-thirds to this and one-third to that. And so as far as spontaneous Hall effects, the reason why we think this is interesting, I mean, so it has a couple of curious features, namely that you don't need explicitly to break time reversal, let's say, by applying magnetic fields. You can get it spontaneously from a particular type of chiral spin ordering. So basically, you have two ingredients. You have spin ordering and itinerant electrons, which are sitting on top of that. And in principle, they can even come from different orbitals in the simplest case. So you can imagine that some orbitals are more localized, providing you spins, and some orbitals less localized, providing you conduction. So you can end up with an insulator which spontaneously breaks continuous symmetry. It's a magnet. And at the same time, breaks sizing symmetry, which is chirality. And as a result, one can end up with having integer quantum pole effect with H states and all that nice stuff. So in fact, there are a couple of other examples which are known. So probably the earliest one by Nagaose in 2000 and the more recent one by Xucheng. I guess the reason we're proud of this particular model is that the effects already occurs in low coupling, in weak coupling limits, where in fact many things can be done in a controlled fashion. So anyway, so let's start with the part one. And since we didn't see or hear too many talks about graphene in this conference, so let me just take the liberty of draw something from lattices and explain what the Hamiltonian is. So this is the picture of graphene. It's honeycomb lattice. As such, it has two atoms per unit cell. If we go to the momentum space at low energies, we get to those famous or infamous drag cones, and there are two distinct k points where this happens, k and k prime. And one is the time reversed over the other. And so if we just focus at this low energy subspace, and then we get a 4x4 Hamiltonian for a second forgetting melt spin, which will just replicate everything twice. So the first two lines will correspond to a particular valley, let's say valley k. The other two lines correspond to valley k prime. And then essentially, so what I want to denote by those color coding, those color dots, is that these two lines, actually, the first line corresponds to one sublattice, and the second line corresponds to the other sublattice. So I'm spending a bit of time on this for the reason that those sigmas which are appearing here, they do correspond not to spin, which we got used to listening and hearing during the past 2 weeks, but rather to sublattice. While tau in this notation represents the valley. So tau has all the properties which we expect from the spin degree of freedom. So it's a time reversed a lot, and the time reversal operation is really tau y times charge conjugation. While sublattice not being a real spin, doesn't really have any particular time reversal symmetry. It's just if one wants to time reverse, one just complex conjugates.
So the spin index is missing, so you should generally think about this as...
That's right. So there, think of it as just basically two copies. So spin is...
Spinless.
Yeah. I mean, so you can think of the spinless or two copies of the spinless. Okay. So that's that. Now, the interesting physics begins to happen if we throw in a mass into this description. And the mass is the simplest mass possible. It's basically imbalance between two sublattices. So we make one site at a different energy than the other. So now that's the Hamiltonian. So the mass is basically this m sigma z term. And I remind you again that so this Hamiltonian is still completely time reverse invariant. And this term, as you notice, is not the same as K and Millet introduced in the spin orbits. But we'll get back to that in a second. So the Hamiltonian is basically two blocks of 2x2, and then we know how to calculate the spin hole if we just focus on one of those sectors. It's this formula in terms of the G vector, which parameterizes Hamiltonian. So it's a three-dimensional vector. That's roughly how it looks like. If we calculate this expression, we find that the quantum hole conductance is E squared over H times 1/2. It also depends on the sign of the mass, but not on the magnitude, obviously. And it is of different sign for the two different valleys. Okay. And in fact, this observation was made by Gordon Semenov 40, more than 20 years ago, who basically observed this effect, pointed it out, but then he said that, I mean, it's not extremely interesting since this valley current doesn't couple to electromagnetic field, so therefore it's not really something straightforwardly or maybe at all measurable. So let's basically pay attention to a couple of things here. And
so you have to add the two. I mean, so there's no 1/2.
That's why he says one half is suspicious.
That's right. So one half is really
together, right? So there isn't really a one half.
No, I mean, okay. So you mean to add together two spins?
That's no, no, no. Just one. If you look at just one valley, there's a one half, but you have both valleys, don't you? So
yeah, that's right. And they come with different signs. So if you add them together, you end up with zero.
Right.
As a matter of fact. So you have basically half of quantum Hall conductance in one valley, another half in the other, but they're sort of opposing each other. So but one half is really bad, right? Because we know that quantum holes, they have to be associated with some kind of edge states, and having half of the edge state in a non-interacting system is not really something reasonable, I would say. So that's one observation. But the other is that, okay, so if we really want to, even if we invent some way to observe the effect, and I'll show you how one can do it, one's still left with the problem of creating a mass for those basically, I mean, imbalance between sublattices, which we know doesn't happen in graphene, since carbon's all the same. However, as to put it into context of this workshop, as Kane and Millay pointed out, one can introduce a symmetry allowed mass term, which is coming from spin orbits, and then things begin to make more sense. Because what really one needs to do in order to calculate what the transverse conductivity is going to be is just to clearly just to multiply the previous result by tau z as z trace over the valley, and you immediately get the expression for the quantum spin conductance, which was obtained by K and Millay. So moreover, what makes everybody happy is that now this effect has been detected, and since we've seen this picture about 100 times in the past 2 weeks, let me not spend time on that. So what about the valley hole effects? So is it really some kind of just thing in itself, which is not really observable, or there is a way to observe it? And so the answer to these questions that we propose is that yes. And to do that, as it relates, we need to do two things. We need to find a way to introduce mass in the system. And the second point is we have to get away from the sort of problem, which definitely going to affect the observability of the effect because of the scattering, short-range scattering at the edges. So, and the claim is that the natural playground for that is bilayer graphene. So bilayer graphene is actually quite similar to the single layer. I mean, we don't really break any translational symmetries, so the Brillouin zone is exactly the same as before. But clearly we have now twice as many, I mean, the dimension of the Hamiltonian is increased by a factor of two. So let me just tell you in a little bit what the Hamiltonian is. And so the way to look at it is if we just focus on a particular valley, let's say K, then the Hamiltonian from one sheet and from the other sheet, they're exactly identical. But then we also have the sort of the biggest matrix element which connects the two layers is the hopping between atoms which are sitting right on top of one another. So essentially coupling between, let's say, A sublattice in one layer and B sublattice in the other layer, and that's the steep curve. So even this way, it's pretty complicated Hamiltonian, but it turns out that if we just focus on energies which are below T-perp, we can easily simplify it. And instead of having this 4x4 piece, we have basically 2x2. And it does bear a lot of resemblance to the original Dirac Hamiltonian, but now instead of having px minus ipy and px plus ipy, we have those guys squared. So the band structure is actually quite unusual. So although it's quadratic, it's not really the, you know, our familiar usual non-relativistic particles. Rather, we have two parabolites touching each other at the k points of the Brillouin zone. So basically, the dispersion is plus minus p squared.
So does that change if you include further neighbor?
That's right. So you do break this. You introduce a little bit of a gap if you introduce further neighbor hoppings.
There's a gap?
I think so, yeah. Or maybe it's a... So the thing is that the effect is... So this point is not really as well protected as the Dirac point. So you definitely can break this symmetry. But in reality, when you look at the modifications with the band structure because of this further neighbor hopping thing, they're really small.
You can split that quadratic band touching.
Yeah.
You can split it into four Dirac nodes.
You can split that into four Dirac nodes.
Yeah. That's consistent with the symmetry.
So if you destroy
them, move away from the that point, and one stays in the middle. And you need the net vorticity to be 2, that's this quadratic mode.
Oh, I see.
You can do it plus 3 and minus 1.
I see. So you split the double one. Yeah, I see. Okay.
Yeah, so I didn't worry about this too much because, as you'll see, I'm going to do much more violence to the system.
So with the translationally invariant hopping term, you can make it gapped. Is that what you're
saying? I think if you introduce some kind of, I can't remember exactly now what it was, but
without breaking any symmetry.
That's right. So if you hop, let's say from black lattice over here to the yellow lattice over there, I think you already modify the dispersion. But
I thought that if the two sublattices are equivalent, if the two layers are equivalent, then I thought the gap was protected.
I think in that case you have a six-fold symmetry, right? If you choose the center to be, if you choose the rotation center to get center of the hexagon, then if the two layers are just on top of each other, you have six-fold symmetry. Whereas now you only have three-fold symmetry.
Anyway, so that's an interesting question. I agree with you, but
no, one more question. Sorry,
it's not particularly crucial.
So what happens if you put a potential difference between top and bottom layer?
So that's precisely what I'm going to do.
Okay.
Because indeed, so what we want to do is to make this dispersion gapful, and then there is a chance of getting something interesting. And the nice thing about bilayer graphene is that indeed it's not that hard anymore because. This line in the Hamiltonian really corresponds to, let's say, top layer and, let's say, A sublattice. And this one corresponds to the bottom layer and B sublattice. So really, those sublattices are the interstitials, the place where the atoms don't connect to the other layer. So by introducing the central layer bias, which one can imagine basically doing by applying electrostatic potential, sticking it into a capacitor, one introduces diagonal terms, mass terms. And so then again, we have our favorite 2x2 Hamiltonian, which can be parameterized by vector G, and we can sort of go through the whole procedure of calculating the quantum Hall effect. So let's see what happens. It's not that surprising, really, because so originally we had this G vector forming a single neuron. Now it is a double neuron in the vicinity of the Dirac points, we can go through the procedure, and since the winding is double, we get twice the original effect. So this 1/2 is gone, and we're kind of happy, but still, that doesn't solve our problem, because clearly, if we have a finite sample with an edge, at the edge of the sample, basically the roughness of the edge would scatter us between valleys, and therefore destroy the effect, and we would have completely uninteresting insulate. So, therefore, we have to really sort of think of a better way. But before I go there, so let me just, since there was a question from Shu-Chang earlier, or let's say statements. So what is the correspondence between various Hall effects that we have now? So a quantum Hall effect is, of course, the strongest of them all, because we have chiral edges, so nothing can backscatter unless we go from one edge to the other, or if we really mess up the bulk. So it's the most stable. Now, quantum spin Hall effect is stable against potential disorder and spin orbit disorder, but if we put some magnetic disorder, that's definitely detrimental. So then, for the quantum valley Hall effect, I mean, spin is really like a dummy variable, so the color now here denotes the valley. So in the same valley, both spins are moving in the same direction. Opposite valley moves in the opposite direction. So therefore, you see that spin scattering time reversal is not so crucial, but really what matters is whether we do or do not have scattering in between valleys, which at the edges, clearly one always does. But alternatively, what we can do now, since we have quite a bit of flexibility, we can choose the sign of mass by basically playing with the potential difference between the layers. We can have a practically realizable possibility where the gap on one side, or mass on one side is positive, the gap on the other side is negative, and then essentially we have a double ditch in a sense. So if you think about quantum Hall states, it's as if you had nu equal to 1 on one side and nu equal to minus 1 on the other side, and then it's known that you get to the snake states, which are existing just at the boundary. Or another way to look at it is, say if it were nu 1 and nu minus 1, you get two chiral states in the middle. So it's exactly the same thing. But now the difference is that, so it's basically helical in the sense that one valley moves in one way and the other valley is going the other way. And again, so as far as realizability, it's not so, conceptually it's not hard, because again, we just need to apply opposing biases to the capacitors, which sandwich are bilayer. And by doing numerical calculation, anyone can. The trouble is that analytically, this kind of equation for general potential phi is not easy to solve. At least I don't know how to do it. You can do it for some special cases. But numerically, there is no problem. And you find indeed that there are states which are localized right at the interface between the regions of different mass. Although the equation, so I'd like to stress, is not really a Dirac equation anymore. It's this second order partial differential. Nevertheless, one can calculate dispersions. And indeed, as we already got used to doing this workshop, we get to the edges which look chiral if we focus just on one spin or one valley. So the other valley would be going in the opposite direction. So all the phenomenology is actually quite similar, I would say, to the spin hole. Now, so let's think about something sort of semi-practical. So what this kind of thing could be good for, because I just argued it's possible to make. So this thing would be really like a valley filter. So if we attach to the battery and we pass current, let's say, in the down direction, then the current would be flowing. We're guaranteed that the current will be flowing in the K prime valley. If we pass in the opposite direction, it will be flowing in the K valley. So which is nice. But of course, you realize that as soon as this valley polarized current hits a copper wire, it becomes completely useless. That by itself is not a great achievement. So therefore, we need to do something more complicated. And more complicated in the sense that we utilize this valley polarization internally without really coupling to the external world. And the simplest possibility that at least we could come up with is the following. Let's say we have two of those valley filters. So here we have positive mass, here we have negative mass, and we have another one guy just like this in series. So if we arrange the biasing, the masses precisely the way that I have drawn here, then we have a mode which is going to be gapless, basically one-dimensional channel, which is sitting in the K valley and which can propagate all the way from top to the bottom. Okay. So if we inject current I here, we get current I down the drain. On the other hand, if we cross-polarize those filters, so this one is polarized one way, but the other one is polarized in the opposite direction, and then you can tell that the state which we injected into this one-dimensional mode, it can only propagate sideways. It cannot go all the way, unless there is some intra-valley scattering in between. And therefore, in this configuration, it will split half into the right lead and half into the left lead. So that's a valley valve. So it's a nice device, except that, of course, we don't know yet what it's good for.
For this kind of, is it necessary to have K and K prime to be the different point in the ribbon geometry? Let's say it should be the zigzag, not the armchair. Armchair in the ribbon geometry, K and K prime reduces to the same point in K space.
In the ribbon, well, one has to think. I mean, with the ribbons, of course, the KK prime is pretty much conserved, right, if you have zigzag edge. But, and Carlo Benacker has been thinking quite a bit about that. I don't want to go too much into detail, but I just want to point out that clearly there is an issue with ribbons in reality, in real world, because you're always going to have some scattering, and therefore it's not really a very practical geometry. So that's that stuff. So now, so what are the interesting possibilities out there? At least the ones that we are planning to look into in a bit more detail. So this is the sort of simplest structure that one can imagine. But clearly, you can define various one-dimensional channels by applying different gate voltages, positive, negative. And we are guaranteed that in all those one-dimensional channels, we're going to have those helical one-dimensional gapless liquids. And therefore, there's a possibility of doing RNN-bomb non-local transport. And then there is sort of slightly different. If we couple it to superconductivity and magnetism, there's also a chance to ask exactly the same, or at least similar questions as in the spin hole. And something that, again, Carla was pointing out, that, so there is this interest in splitting cooler pairs. You can ask exactly the same questions in this system. And then, of course, it's interesting what happens if we turn on interactions and what kind of Lagrange liquids one can get, or, oh, it's me. Okay, should I turn it off? Let me just do this. Okay. Yes. Otherwise, you would find out all the secrets that I have on my desktop. So. Yeah, so there are questions like this, and of course there is this sort of more general question about the relation between spin and valley. I mean, so what is the connection if there is something, you know, that needs to be understood there? So, nobody notices time, I hope, right?
Except the chairwoman.
So 5 minutes maybe, is that okay?
Minus 5 minutes.
Yeah, okay, I'm sorry. So, but I promise it will be interesting. Okay, so this is basically quantum Hall effect, spontaneous Hall effect, one can call in interacting systems. And so what we consider here is ephemeral electrons which can jump on the lattice. And so these electrons are coupled through Hund's interaction with local moments. And now, for simplicity, let's just assume that those moments are fully classical. So they're basically just local magnetic fields. Okay. So now, what do we know? We know that if this Hund's coupling is really strong, then electrons, when they jump along the lattice, they are forced to align their spins with the local moments. And then we know that as a result of that, there will be a phase accumulation. And this phase is basically indistinguishable from the one which would be produced by a real magnetic field. And it is related to the solid angle, which is spanned by those vectors through the following relationship. And the solid angle for small angles, is basically a triple product. And incidentally, this combination is known as a scalar spin chirality. Okay, so this is a well-known effect, but now the question that we ask is, so if it's possible to have, let's say, an extended two-dimensional system where this spin chirality, scalar spin chirality would be uniform, because if this would be so, plus if the system were insulating, then it would have built-in quantum Hall effect. So, and of course, I wouldn't be asking this question if I didn't know the answer. And this is the texture. And it turns out to be actually quite, it's definitely non-coplanar, but it's not so complicated as it looks. In fact, it just contains four sublattices, 1, 2, 3, 4, and those sublattices correspond to spin orientations, which you would get by looking from the center of a cube into the four corners connected by the diagonal. So essentially, it has tetrahedral symmetry. Now, so what's interesting about this state is the following. because, I mean, as I mentioned in the beginning, Ordi Nelson and Galsa and collaborators looked in 2000 at a relay problem on a Kagome lattice, and they found this kind of quantum Hall effect. So, but there you really need to assume that you have very strong Kohn's coupling, and that the spin configuration is pretty much unrelated to conduction electrons. It just exists. So the interesting observation for this model on triangle lattice is that, in fact, you can get this kind of ordering for free just by virtue of having this interaction between local moments and conduction electrons. And the way it happens is the following. if we look at the...
Actually, can you go back for a moment? Is that last C sub I beta?
Yes, you're right. I copied it, I guess, from here. And yeah. Right, so it's basically it's just on site. So it's really simple, a double exchange type of model. So, and that's crucial because then interaction is completely Q independent, and everything really lives on the susceptibility of electrons, and that's precisely what matters. So this is basically just extended Brillouin zone structure for triangle lattices, bunch of hexagons, and if we fill it just trites, namely to 3/4, this shaded hexagon is the Fermi surface at this particular filling. Okay, and you see it's again, it's piecewise linear. Therefore, you naturally expect that there will be divergent susceptibilities, and in fact, they are. So if you look at those vectors, QA, Q, B, Q, C, essentially if you go along the lines, so basically along these directions, susceptibility is divergent all the way on this kind of weird triangle lattice in two-dimensional space. But it is most divergent for these particular Q vectors. Okay, so one can...
What is the divergence?
Susceptibility, if you calculate susceptibility for electrons.
Because what?
So first of all, you have nesting, right? Because the Fermi surface...
I would take the horizontal...
That's right, but yeah. It's a triangle lattice, so if you add reciprocal, then you find... Because, so this is one Fermi surface, and this is exactly the same Fermi surface, right? So if I basically connect this point to that point, it's the same as connecting, let's say, to that point. Right, so it's the same. So we have perfect nesting, plus we have one-hole singularities, so all of that conspires in order to make, in fact, for fixed length spins, for classical spins, this kind of spin configuration the only one that remains, which is synergetically favorable, and that indeed happens for the weak couple. So just 1 minute. So this is the band structure in the reduced Brillouin zone. You see the four sheets. And indeed, the key is that although these bands begin overlapping for intermediate couplings, these two, the uppermost two bands, they don't overlap all the way down to a zero coupling. So this is the sort of the simplest possible calculation. We have fixed spins. We calculate the band structure of that subject. Now, we can also do something a bit more subtle. We can say that the spins are really coming from the Hubbard. So we have Hubbard-like model, and then we can calculate both the order parameter behaviors, function temperature, and the quantum hole conductance. And we see that quantum hole actually is a good proxy to the order parameter itself. Then, of course, the next step is to go beyond mean field, include fluctuations, and that's the long wavelength theory for the thing. And several interesting questions arise about, of course, role of fluctuations, about the topological defects in the structure, which is, to start with, is completely rotation invariant. So the order parameter is SO3. We can have zeta vortices. We can have charges in those zeta vortices. And so the most interesting question of them all, if anybody had any ideas, I would be really fascinated, is about the crossover from large spin, which we considered here, and the quantum spin. Okay, so the same. If it's connected to chiral spin liquids and such. So sorry for overriding the time done.
Saying to the very end. So this is going to be brief. So I sort of put this together after, you know, late dinner last night. And so this is mainly supposed to, I think I'd like it to be more of a discussion than a talk. And in particular, we were hoping we could sort of include lots of the younger people who are going to be the future of this field into the discussion. So I really invite you to participate. So I just want to say a couple words about what we've done and where we're headed, and with the caveat that it's going to be biased and incomplete. So please feel free to speak up. Okay. So what have we done? So experimentally, I think when we came here, we sort of had the transport in the Mercury Academy of Telluride and the Arcus on the bismuth antimony, and that's sort of what drew us here. And I think that's very exciting, and it's really nice to see the more recent transport data from Lawrence about the non-local transport, and I think that's very exciting. We know heard a little bit about surface transport and bismuth antimony. I think we'd like to hear more about that. Okay, this was from Fun On. I think one of the most exciting experimental things that has come up during this conference is this breakthrough that we now have a new material for a three-dimensional topological insulator, and this material has potential to be really, really nice. In particular, it has a large energy gap, which is much larger than what we had before. And in principle, the Fermi surface is very simple. And in fact, I believe that in the ideal case, the Fermi surface should really be at a point that one should have the Fermi energy right at the Dirac point. Okay, and so this is a real breakthrough. I think this is going to be something which we are going to be talking about for some time. So that's experimental. Theoretically, again, we sort of came here with the characterization of topological insulators, and so one can characterize them by variance on the TKNN invariant, and one can understand characterize them by their surface and edge states. And we also heard the nice characterization in terms of a field theory, characterizing a three-dimensional topological insulator by EFB. Okay, and so this is an exciting development. So at this conference, one of the things which emerged, which I think is really interesting, is that there's a whole set of topological phases, particularly when one expands the set to include superconductors. And so what's emerged, so we had several sort of mathematical talks which sort of pointed to the same periodic table of phases that you can have. And, it's sort of like the periodic table of the elements, where, the structure of the periodic table of the elements is determined by the mathematical structure of the rotation group, basically.
And by the number 8.
No, not the periodic. No, I'm talking about the periodic table of the elements.
Yes,
it does.
Yeah,
it has 8 columns. It's the period.
Well, no, it starts with 2 and then 8.
Yeah. But the regular table you look at has 8 columns.
So, okay, but. So in any case, so the thing which I think is amazing, which has come out of this, is that mathematics gives a similar set of topological states, at least for free fermions. Okay, so for sort of states that one can describe with free fermions, there's a finite set of classifications that one can have, and so in this talk there were different ways of getting at this. So either by some abstract K theory, or by studying the connection with the universality classes of random Hamiltonians, or by the sort of Chern-Simons theories that would, in phase space. These three different approaches seem to be pointing in the same direction, and I think that
there will be a virtue for us to try to understand each of these, and they may give us, you know, there may be sort of some synergy that one can get by understanding these different approaches to the problem. Okay, and so this is sort of a mathematical classification, but you know, we really learned something new. You know, so we learned some insights into the original space that we were interested in, but we also predicted some new, you know, topological superconductors, and so there's things to go out and look for. So then another thing which emerged is understanding the proximity effects, and they're really, so by this I mean on the surface of a three-dimensional topological insulator, what can you do to open a gap? And there's sort of two ways you can do it, either with a magnetic or a superconducting gap, and these are both interesting. Okay, so for the magnetic gap, one gets this half quantized quantum Hall effect, and this is related to this magneto-electric effect, and on the superconducting side, then one has this non-trivial superconducting state that can support Majorana fermions. Okay, so these are sort of so my view of the biggest sort of theoretical advances, and maybe there are others that people would like to talk about, but I didn't list everything, but no. Okay, so all right, so. So where do we go from here? And so I just sort of wrote down a list of things, and I was really hoping that we could discuss this further. I'm not sure I could think of everything. Okay, and so what are the future frontiers? And so I think bismuth-selenide is one future frontier. So one of the things experimentally that we have to do is we have to make it into a good material. Okay. And so my understanding is that bismuth-selenide is typically a crappy material, and so with lots of vacancies, and it's usually doped. So what one needs to do, the first thing we need to do is we need to compensate it. Okay. So that the Fermi energy is in the gap. Okay, and if we can do that, then I would hope that there's a good chance that the surface will have Fermi energy right at the Dirac fault. Okay, that's the it has this beautiful simple structure, and if that's the case, then that makes it into a material which one has real hope of being able to, you know. So if you put it in a magnetic field, it's going to be better graphene than graphene is. Okay, in a sense, well, there's only one Dirac point, but it's just like graphene in that there should be a quantum Hall effect in very weak magnetic fields. So it has this, you know, the Dirac structure means that the lambda levels go like square root of b. So one could have, you know, a room temperature, you know, fractional integer quantum Hall effect. So I think that would be really exciting, and then it also, you know, depositing magnetic materials on it, that might be a way of you know, opening up a gap without putting on a magnetic field. Okay, and as well, it would be interesting to try to figure out superconductors which like to sit next to this, okay, without a big choppy barrier. Okay. So for bismuth antimony, we have this idea that niobium should work pretty well. At least there's some experimental evidence that that's the case. So one would like to find a superconductor that likes bismuth selenide. Okay. And so once we have this material, or maybe even one could do it on bismuth antimony, you know, I think that there's a lot of room for studying the electronic transport in the surface.
But bismuth antimony may not be easy to get, right? Even if you don't have a Schottky. To
with a superconductor? I'm not sure about that. It's a metal, you know, so it might be possible to make it superconductor. I'm not sure having a big Fermi surface is that much of a problem.
Right.
It's not as much of a problem as it is to make it a magnetic.
Right.
Okay. Yeah, good point. Yeah. Okay. Right, so I think it would be nice to see surface state transport and things which coupled with spin. So it was very nice. So I think Lauren's experiment, you know, where he had the edge states of the quantum Hall effect and then probing the spin by using the metallic spin Hall effect. I think that was a really exciting. You know, that was really the first time that we used spin as quantum spin Hall effect, right? And so. So,
what's that? Because
you kill quantum
spin. But no, but spin. I mean, so you know, and so I think that you know, there may be similar sort of interesting effects on the surface of a topological insulator. You know, because especially in the simple case with in bismuth selenide, where one has just a single Fermi surface, if you put a spin in, then depending on what the spin is, it's going to go off in different directions. Okay, and so there may be interesting things that one can think about doing with that.
And let me just say, there's no RTK wire track; it's all the ferromagnetic side.
So
it's like a dream for semiconductors, electronics people.
Yeah.
Because if they dope ordinary magnetic atom into a semiconductor host, they have random RKK wire interaction getting to spin cross. But if you have a single Dirac point, put a spin, two spin always interact ferromagnetically because of the Dirac physics.
Okay, so related to some of this, I think studying the surfaces locally could have some interesting physics in it as well. And so I was actually really sorry that Ali Azani was not able to come. I was hoping to hear something about this. I expect there will be if one can do some sort of spin polarized STM or something like that, there will be interesting interference effects that one can observe on the surfaces of topological insulators. So Fan An gave this talk about graphene, where there was these weird thermoelectric effects, the Nernst effect, and things like that. I think there may be interesting thermoelectric effects to look at in the topological insulators. After all, these materials are known for their thermoelectric properties. Okay, and so I think it would be interesting to come to understand those effects and to what extent the surfaces are playing a role in the thermoelectric properties of those materials. Okay. All right, so we want to be able to gap the surface states with magnetic and superconducting gaps. I think that if we can do that, there will be a lot of interesting physics to do. And of course, my hope is that we can beat the quantum Hall effect people to the Majorana fermion. Okay, so, okay, so we have to do that. We can do it. Okay. Okay. So another avenue to go on, which I think was really brought out in Mato Gagosa's talk, was that there's lots of fertile ground in the interplay between strong correlation and strong spin orbit. Okay, and so we've been focusing on materials where electron correlations are not so important, okay? But there are lots of other materials out there too. And so in particular, Nagaosa talked about this iridium compound, and argued that that should be a weak topological insulator. And I think that, and he made the point that, that the d-electron systems mimic the p-electron systems. So there's similarities in them. And so I think, there are probably a lot of other materials that are waiting to be discovered that have interesting topological properties. Okay, and then finally, that leads to a more general problem, which is probably too hard. Okay, much harder. So there are two different kinds of topological. Okay, there's topological as in thallus, okay, which we've sort of generalized to talk. So it's topological classifications of free fermion Hamiltonians. Okay, and so that's one kind of topological. But there's also topological order as in the fractional quantum Hall effect. Okay, where maybe one classifies the ground state degeneracy on a torus and things like that. So those are two different notions of topological order, and they're really sort of disconnected from one another. Okay, so from the point of view of the Wendt's topological order, we're all trivial. But there must be some more general setting in which one can talk about both of these on the same footing. Okay, and I think that's what it's about.
Unifies this too.
Which transcendental theory?
Well, okay. Transcendental theory, you have both for integer and for fractional.
Only for quantum.
Yeah, okay, that's true. Okay, but I don't think we have a general, for our periodic table of band oscillators, we do not have a theory which generalizes to interactions. So the phase space, the phase space turn Simon's theory that you write down. Once you talk about the phase space, you're talking about electrons, right? Yeah. Okay. So I think I think the challenge is going to be, I think in general this is probably too hard a problem, but so the challenge is going to be to try to take little steps towards solving this problem, and that maybe we can make progress with. Okay. And then finally, I wrote this down as an invitation to the audience. So can we make anything useful out of this? Okay. And so I think that's a question we should really think about deeply. Okay. Because maybe we can. Okay. I'm not sure I know the answer to that, but. There's really we've discovered new physics, and I think we should think about this. Okay, so that's sort of what I had to say. So let me just conclude by saying thank you. So first, thank you to the KITP for hosting us. It's wonderful to come to this beautiful place and this beautiful building and have this venue where we could meet. This was the right time for this conference. So thank you very much. And then there were various people who gave us money. So some of the younger people were supported by the Institute for Complex Adaptive Matter, and then some of us had our whole stage paid for by Microsoft. And then I also like to thank Leon and Lawrence and Shucheng for all the work that they did putting this thing together, and most of all, all of the participants, I think, made this into really a successful 2 weeks, and so I'd like to thank you very much.
David, do you like to say a few words?
what's
happening? Because tomorrow? People are leaving.
Oh, goodbye. Come back. Now this is a great workshop. We have these rapid response workshops that we started a few years ago, and this has been one of the most successful ones. But only by a little bit. They've all been extraordinarily successful, so I'm really satisfied with it. I'm just unhappy that the money that supports this, which has largely been taken out of our cobbly gift, which is rapidly disappearing, But this was great. I mean, this was a theoretical plus experimental breakthrough, and good timing. I mean, this was within 6 months of the idea, right?
Yeah.
More or less. But we're very happy that this mode works so well when we can correctly identify a hot field. And this is certainly hot. I encourage the organizers to think of a full-length program, 3 or 6 months somewhere, and probably 2011. Which is the period we're now beginning to, the next few months going to choose. Looks like with all that work to be done, there'll be stuff left to talk about. So congratulations to everyone involved. Great program. What are you going to do tomorrow?
Swim to the beach.